I'm Bill Castle, and this is Free Expression. This program is all about conveying the Christian message from a Catholic point of view and defending the liberty which makes it possible to do that. We talk with creative, interesting people about strengthening family life through shared productive work and harsh punishments for those dedicated to saving the unborn. Join us. Sit back and enjoy some free expression. Is a long-time and well-known pro-life activist. Her book, Abandoned, The Untold Story of the Abortion Wars, is widely considered to be the definitive account of America's conflict over protecting the preborn. She's been tracking the arrest and prosecution of a group of activists involved in a rescue operation at a Washington, D.C. abortion center. She recently distributed an appeal for letters to the judge overseeing that case, asking for fairness in treatment of the defendants. Monica, could you explain the background of your appeal and where this situation stands right now?
In October of 2020, 11 pro-lifers did a rescue at an abortion center in Washington, D.C., the Washington Surges Center, that's operated by the abortionist Cesare Santangelo, and he does abortions there. It's apparently legal in Maryland to do abortions on demand through the ninth month of pregnancy. They staged this rescue, and they knew that they were probably going to be charged with the Freedom of Access to Clinic Entrances Act.
Right.
This is a 1994 law that was signed by Bill Clinton to prevent pro-lifers from blocking the doors of abortion clinics or blocking the hallway that leads to the abortion rooms and so on. But unprecedented in the history of legalized abortion, these pro-lifers were charged with an additional federal quote-unquote crime, and that was conspiracy to interfere with civil rights. That has a 10-year maximum jail sentence, prison term, and a $350,000 maximum fine. Now, going into this rescue, because they were going to be blocking the hallway to prevent the killing of the babies, they anticipated, of course, that they would be charged with FACE. That's a one-year jail term maximum. I was present at the trials. The pro-lifers were tried in batches, shall we say. So the first five were in August. Then the next three were in September. Then later on, Paulette Harlow stood trial by herself. One pro-lifer actually decided to plead guilty. He's a single father of two children. He got a 10-month jail term, and that was, he may be almost ready to finish that, and that would be Juanito Estevez, who participated in the rescue. So everybody got convicted. I have articles about the trials on crisismagazine.com if people want to look them up. Oh, and there's also, actually, now that I'm thinking about it, links to those articles at Pro-Life Society. ProLifeSociety.com. So they all got convicted of the FACE and the conspiracy. Eight of them have been sitting in jail since their trials. Paulette, because she has very severe health issues, was allowed to be on house arrest in Massachusetts, where she lives, pending sentencing. Now the sentencing is almost upon us. The sentencing is also going to be done in phases. The first five will be sentenced by Judge Colleen Kohler Cotoli, federal judge in Washington, D.C., on May 14th. Then the next three will be sentenced on the 15th of May, and then Paulette will be sentenced by herself on the 17th of May, and I intend to be at the sentencing. This is very, very serious. The federal department that handles, and I'm not sure what the name of it is, but there's a federal department that handles what's called sentencing recommendation. Some of these rescuers, it's recommended that they will sit in federal prison for 6 years, some of them for 4 years, some of them for 2 years. Those are the recommendations going into the sentencing that will happen in the middle of May. Again, unprecedented in the history of legalized abortion. You have to put this in context. These pro-lifers did nothing more than what we would call basically a sit-in type of activity. On behalf of the unborn babies that were scheduled to be aborted, they tried to reach out to the moms. I must have watched 30 videos of this rescue while I was in court last August and then again in September. So I really know what they did, how they did it, and so on. So we are asking for people to show their support for these pro-lifers. And that means please write a letter to the judge on their behalf. Plead for leniency. They've already been sitting in jail for months waiting to be sentenced. Enough is enough. They don't deserve to be punished at all. I mean, if anybody belongs in jail, it's the abortionist. Killing babies, human beings, through the ninth month of pregnancy. I mean, it's absolutely hideous what this man does. Interestingly enough, again, if you read my articles about the trials, you'll see these pro-lifers never received a fair trial. The unborn remained completely invisible. What San Angelo does in that abortion clinic remained completely invisible. The jury was never allowed to weigh the goods that were at stake regarding the rescue that these pro-lifers conducted. It was a travesty. It really was, from beginning to end.
The obvious question that comes to my mind is, why have these extra charges been layered on?
Well, the conjecture, maybe it's more than conjecture, is under the Biden administration, the Department of Civil Rights and the Department of Justice under Garland has become aggressively pro-abortion. They want to shut down pro-life activity, and this was basically a show trial. Okay, I'm not saying people should vote for whoever, but this never would have happened under the Trump administration. I almost can guarantee it. Maybe they would have been charged with FACE, and that would have been it. But to add this additional charge has really changed the legal landscape. Now, you know, having said all of that, I've been participating since 2017 in what are called Red Rose Rescues. In Red Rose Rescues, we deliberately do not block anything. We don't block anyone. At the most, six pro-lifers will go into the waiting room of an abortion center, sit down in the waiting room, and try to talk to the moms, to try to persuade them to give life to their babies, offer them help, and so on. But we don't block anything, which means that Red Rose Rescues have not been subject to the FACE law. Because the FACE law has to do with physically obstructing ingress and egress, the free movement of people. So we don't do that in a Red Rose Rescue. So I think I could safely say that had they opted to do that sort of rescue, we probably would not be facing these very draconian punishments. So if people would please write a letter, this would take you 20 minutes to plead for leniency, to impress on Judge Kohler Cotoli that these people are good people. Some of them might actually be living saints, honestly, that they acted to defend life. She should take that into consideration. And the other interesting thing, a few years ago, the pro-life group Live Action did a undercover sting video with Sant Angelo, with the abortionist. He admitted on the video, and I saw the video, okay? I mean, you can watch it. It's online. Just go to the Live Action website. You can take a look at it. He admits that occasionally, in a late-term abortion procedure, the fetus will be born alive, and he admits that they just let them die. That's how bad it is. The jury never saw that video. The judge would not permit them to see it. We may have a completely different verdict if there had been real justice exposing the horror and the injustice of abortion. The verdict may have been very, very different. So these are things that need to be brought forward in writing to Judge Kohler Cotoli. I have everything on our website, prolifesociety.com. Her address, the background of this case, the names of the defendants are all there. So I'm really hoping that people will at least write a letter. The letters have to be on her desk by May 13th. That's because the sentencing starts on the 14th of May. So we still have a window of time here, almost 3 weeks. So I'm hoping people will do this, write these letters. I think she ought to receive thousands of letters. She needs to see that these are not, quote unquote, ordinary criminals, all right? These are good people who tried to do a good thing. And they don't deserve to be in jail.
Well, since so much information appears to have been withheld, is there a basis for appeal in these cases?
Oh, absolutely, there is, but it's very unlikely that she would stay the sentencing pending the appeal. If she gives them additional jail time in the sentencing, they're going to be sitting in jail while the appeal goes forward.
Well, once again, where can people go to find the address and any other related information?
Right, super easy. Just go to Pro-Life Society, no hyphens, prolifesociety.com. Everything is up on the homepage.
Monica Miller, thanks very much for bringing us up to date on this. I hope people respond aggressively.
Yeah, me too. And thank you for this opportunity, and God bless you.
Maybe it's a longing for a simpler, more basic style of living. Maybe it's the pressure of modern life or the fear of the uncertainty which seems to increase every day. Maybe it's a desire to get closer to God. Whatever the reason, a lot of people are looking seriously at setting up small farms, growing their own food, returning to a style of life most American families left behind generations ago. There's a spreading movement of homesteaders, many of them Catholic, and that's adding a new dimension to faith life. Jason Craig and his family run a small dairy farm in North Carolina. He and another Catholic homesteader, Thomas Van Horn, describe the challenges and rewards of living on the good earth in a beautiful book from Tan Publishers, The Liturgy of the Land, Cultivating a Catholic Homestead. Jason, I'm very glad you could be with us.
Thanks for having me, Bill.
My wife's an avid gardener. I'm the guy who turns the soil and tends the fences, but we preserve many of our own foods. So we know the satisfaction of harvesting the fruits of the earth, but we also know that it's a lot of work. What you're doing is on a whole different scale. What's the attraction of this life?
I think you said at the beginning, there's lots of motivation for people when they want to move, quote unquote, to the land. And I agree that I think every family at some point catches that itch. But there's a lot of different degrees that you can engage in that. And as we have increased our work on our farm, it's because the family, it's increasingly become part of our culture. We're all sort of doing it together. Obviously, that's the hope and the goal for a lot of people. But I think the primary inspiration for me and for many fathers is they want to be able to work and have households that are integrated. So when you say, well, it's a simpler life, sometimes it's not simpler. It's not simpler to have to care for and feed animals or deal with sick animals or droughts or hay. It's not necessarily simpler, meaning less things to do. It's actually a very complicated, I mean, everything from the soil to the weather, it's all interrelated and it's complicated. But the word, I think, although simple does capture it well, the better word is integrated. I mean, these things, they bring these things that are often separated, our work, our leisure, our food, our culture, our place, you know, all these things we separate from them. And the life of homesteading, the more you engage it, the more it brings those separate things together.
This really does involve the whole family. I see from your book that even your kids are involved.
Absolutely, yeah. We run off child labor. Absolutely, yeah. It's a good thing that child labor laws do not extend to farms and homesteads. But to be sure, our work is that we do on the farm. It is not my job. It is not our income that pays our monetary bills. But our homesteading is to grow food for our family. All of our meat, all of our dairy comes from the farm, and then a good amount of our vegetables. But we have the kids involved because that's kind of the whole point. I didn't want to come here to have more work piled on me so that I just more things to manage. I came here to work with my family. And, you know, we did that. We started about 12 years ago. My kids were younger then, so we've been able to come up in that atmosphere, and the purpose and of our work and the integration of our work has sort of become a whole, and it's our way of life. It's maybe more challenging. We talk about this in the book, if your kids are older or if the whole family's not on board. But I think for many men, and again, I'm speaking as a father here, that of course we're working together. Of course the kids are working. That's the whole reason I'm here. I wanted to hear and say, I want to be about my father's business, like Jesus says of his father. I mean, I want to go do what he's doing. And without this homestead, there wouldn't really be things that I could be doing to bring them into that work.
Now, there are risks in this. Your co-author went into some length of discussion of his honey business and how he had difficulty getting that off the ground and ran into complications that he never expected. Going into this, you got to have your eyes open because it may be really a tough go.
We make the distinction in the book that, you know, when people hear homestead and farm, they use the word interchangeably. And we really focused in on the homesteading, meaning helping the household and the family to become productive, meaning they directly produce their needs. And we took as sort of our starting point, the other end of the spectrum would be the suburban home, which does not produce what it consumes. The household in the suburbs, not to criticize it unnecessarily, but to just observe the reality of it, is that it is a consuming and recreational household. It's not a productive household. It doesn't do and produce things together and work together. Everything you do and you do well, you know, if you're good at work in a suburb, you leave home more. And this, maybe you have a at-home job. Or if you're a really good athlete as a child, you have to leave home more. The more you homestead, the more your home becomes a place of production. And this would include workshops and all sorts of other things, not just growing food. That brings the home into integration. So Tommy talks a lot about if you want to make a productive home also into a business, i.e. a farm, meaning you're making income from the things you're growing, that brings a whole new level, a whole new scale to what you're doing. We actually encourage more people to consider how they can take the route that every home can have a little homestead on the side. And that gives you, at the very least, a little, you know, the smallest amount of good, healthy independence, not the kind of independence that's isolationist, but the kind that's like real security in what you have from the land and all the benefits that you get from having a farm. Tommy ran into all sorts of issues, and we did too. He got into commercial beekeeping and does that full-time still, and that was just a very long and complex journey. And then we've had a dairy on the side for years, and for a while we were grade A commercial, providing yogurts for local coffee shops, things like that. We've subsequently just gone to back to selling milk. You know, I have a friend who says, if you want a homestead, don't start a market garden. I mean, the moment you start turning the life of the family into an income, it does change everything. Not to say that some people can't and shouldn't do that. It's a great thing. But what we're proposing in the book is more for families who want to basically start homesteading as a family.
Now, this involves quite a bit of juggling of time and energy. As you note there, you do work outside the homestead, too. You edit a magazine called Sword and Spade. How do you make it all fall into place?
Part of the reason we wrote the book is that it didn't fall into place. It's been really hard won. I mean, it's been very difficult to learn how to balance, you know, what I call life between laptop and land. The great benefit that a lot of people have is actually, and ironically, you know, in the modern technology of communications technology, a lot of people can work from home. And all of a sudden, this remote work and all that can change overnight. I mean, you can go somewhere. But then to learn to live by what we call the liturgy of the land, it's really a form of conversion. If you're looking for the specifics, the tangibles, how we make it work, it's having a rhythm of work and integration of the family. You know, we get up, we pray, we go milk the cows, we eat breakfast. I have some time in the office. I have some time out of the office where we check in on projects, we check in on the school. We come back together to eat dinner. We go back out and finish our chores. It's just kind of this constant rhythm. The integrating factor for us is our farm. All the things we share together, you know, we try to share a lot of things together, but everything we really share is the work of the farm. Because even if the little ones aren't doing every little chore with the older ones or what have you, we're all eating food, and the food is coming from the farm. We're discussing, you know, what needs to be planted, when it's grown, all that. So the book was written as sort of an unpacking of what Tommy and I have called, you know, our conversion to a way of life that was that we were not formed in. We formed in a more urban, a suburban mindset. And it was hard to form those habits. It's taken quite a while. A lot of us, when we think of homesteading, we just think in kind of the form of technique and life hack, and I'm just going to get some dirt out of the soil. We don't think about it as a completely different way of life that's actually at odds and very contrary to the way we learn how to live in a more suburban model. And if you're not ready for that conversion, then you have to be very careful about how far of a leap you make into this world. And you might need to just tiptoe in or just get a backyard tomato plant before you sell everything and go buy, you know, 3 acres and a milk cow.
What's the spiritual side of this? You use words like conversion, which have a clear religious connotation. This has to have changed your life in a profound way.
Well, it's been spiritually motivated really the whole time. Tommy and I both worked for a Catholic apostolate called Fraternus, which was trying to help fathers and men be better and more intentional mentors to boys, both fatherless and their own sons. And we started asking the question, why are we losing so many men in the faith? Why are we losing so many boys? A lot of us think only in terms of what we might call the softer issues, meaning the immaterial issues of ideologies and relativism and liberalism and these things that we know have caused damage to the faith. But, you know, the research of Alan Carlson, of Mary Eberstadt, who, you know, wrote the book, How the West Really Lost God. If you really dig into the data, what really happened, we didn't lose an argument for God, you know. And then it's not as if the atheists came up with some brilliant argument and we all went, oh, now we can live in an age of reason and we'll be unshackled from superstition and religion. That's not what happened. What actually happened with the secularization of culture is that we lost the family first. And once you lose the family, it's very hard to understand a faith where the son comes to reveal the father so that we can be reconciled as sons and live as brothers and sisters. I mean, Christianity revolves around disclosing itself and sort of the natural beauty of the family. But the context of the family matters. And we have tended to think that our material abundance and our current suburban economic model, which is predominant, that those things are just natural outcomes of free market economics and just inevitability of progress. And what we have failed to see is what has happened to the family. And Mary Eberstadt's very good at showing that in places where there is rapid and sort of unquestioned material abundance or growth, what it actually does to the family. So in the Industrial Revolution, you know, which we rightfully talk a lot about, the father leaves the home. For the first time in history, the father's work is far and away from the home. And then the mother leaves the home. And then the children leave the home. And really, there's nothing left of the home because the home is no longer doing anything together. Hmm. So I would also, in the book, we also point to, you know, the writing of Robert Nisbet, who in the book Quest for Community, he traces that the family, when it becomes just a place of recreation and mutual support, without the hard tasks of providing, of caring for, of growing, fixing, you know, basically when the family stops being a productive unit and only became a consuming unit, and when the family stops being an economic force that does something together, when it stops doing these things, the family declined rapidly. Hmm. So what we can see now, and the research on this is clear, the philosophy on it is something you can really stand on. It's very obvious to anyone who's now experienced it, is that the family is healthier when it's integrated with all of life, including the economic life, production and consumption. Because we can tell our kids until we're blue in the face that the family is the basis of civilization and society. But when they walk out the door, it doesn't seem that way. Our society, you know, based on a consumerist, materialist mindset, begins with really not caring much about the family. You know, the home, which might be giant of the same size, doesn't really have anything going on there during the day. Hmm. There's a daycare for the little ones. There's a school for the older ones. There's an old folks home way down the road, if not in another state, for the grandparents, and the parents are at work and what have you. And that has not been good for the family. So the primary lens that this book is looking through, in the, as far when it comes to the spiritual lens, is that the reason we want to grow food together, and this is not even dealing with our connection with nature. I mean, that should really be a separate question, that God discloses himself and shows us himself through nature. But first, that God makes himself known in the life of the family. And when the family loses itself and loses its functionality, we might think of that as some utilitarian thing, but it's not. It's just that the context of the family, when it works together as a whole, you know, that old saying, a family that prays together stays together, where the family that works together works better. That's the spiritual lens that a lot of us see this through, is that for the sake of all of us reaching God together, not just my own personal piety, but all of us as a household, glorifying God in our work and our relationships, we need to be working together. And the homestead is a good place for that. They're just being freed in some ways from the tyranny of artificiality and media and just everything of our lives being artificial and concrete and fiber optic and all. Just being, having your hands in the soil also helps. All of a sudden, the gospel with its, called out seeds on hard soil and pruning of grapes, all these things make more sense. And it's not as if it was just because, well, Jesus lived in that time, that's all he had as an example. It's that, no, actually, just God shows himself through creation. St. Bernard of Clairvaux said, you know, before you read the book of God, you have to read the book of nature. You know, to summarize that long-winded answer is to say, experiencing the natural world of God shows us something of himself. And working within that natural creation with our family also teaches us about him. And that's really why we're here.
The book is The Liturgy of the Land, Cultivating a Catholic Homestead. It's from Tan Books, and I assume by now it's in general distribution. Where can people find out more about it?
Sure. You can go to theliturgyoftheland.com. You can buy the book there, but you can also sign up, and we're going to be having a conference this winter. The purpose of that, I think, there's a danger, even everything I've said here in this conversation, of getting very enthusiastic about the idea of, you know, quote-unquote, going back to the land. One of the reasons we wrote the book and we want to do the conference is that we've also seen a lot of families, in the name of doing good for the family, do harm without really discerning and understanding what this, like I said, this conversion towards homesteading means. So the conference is meant to help families not just get excited about the idea of moving to land. That's easy. Everyone can get excited. At least a lot of people, a lot of sane people can get very excited about the idea of having a little farm and homestead. But to actually discern it very carefully as a family, theliturgyoftheland.com.
Jason Craig, thank you very much. You've undertaken a way of living that is challenging, but that I can see holds deep satisfactions.
Bill, thanks for having me. It's been great.
Be with us next time when we explore other aspects of religious communication and look deeper into the great Christian heritage of free expression. Free Expression with Bill Castle is a production of Good Shepherd Catholic Radio and Company Publications, where good books, good music, and good radio are always good company. Dan Kuras provided technical assistance. Theme and incidental music are by Dan Adam. The program was produced and directed by Bill Castle. This is Good Shepherd Catholic Radio.